From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a conversation with author Luis Alberto Urrea about family, death, and laughter.
If people could inhabit our world, our family, our humor, our heartbreak, our Americanness, they might stop this craziness and rethink it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Author Luis Alberto Urrea was born in Tijuana to a Mexican father and an American mother. He's best known for his acclaimed novels, but he's also written extensively about the U.S.-Mexico border in the Pulitzer Prize-nominated The Devil's Highway. He brings some of those real concerns of the day to his latest work, the novel The House of Broken Angels. The work is also based on real-life events Urrea experienced in 2016 when his terminally ill half-brother Juan, who over a two-day period attended his mother's funeral and then celebrated what would be his final birthday. The broken angels of the title are the characters Big Angel and Little Angel, and they're loosely based on the two half-brothers, their loves and losses, their relationships with their respective mothers, and a father recalled in mythological terms. Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides spoke with Luis Alberto Urrea about dreamers, border walls, the heartaches and triumphs that families endure, and the ways that broken angels can find a way to bring healing.
How would you describe this novel to someone?
It's like James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, but for Mexicanos, you know? You know, I wanted it to be our Owning America book. You know, I especially watching the political atmosphere in the country and the build the wall and, you know, the anti-Mexicano/Latinx sort of, I couldn't take it anymore. And I thought, no, I love my family and I love our culture and I love our shared languages and I love Spanglish también. And I thought, I am going to try to write an epic to make everybody a member of our families. You know, maybe that'll work because I can't take all of the anger and racism, and I feel like we're backsliding. I feel like, especially in the Chicano movement, you know, people, I think that people were farther along in 1971 than we are now. Our journals disappeared, you know, so many things have been deconstructed. So it was sort of my answer to all of that, that I thought if people could inhabit our world, our family, our humor, our heartbreak, our Americanness, they might stop this craziness and rethink it.
You do make some pretty undeniable nods here in this novel to these racist and xenophobic attitudes in our country. I was just carried along by this very, as you said, your family. And then suddenly there'd be this moment at a Target where somebody said something really vile to these two people. They were surprising moments, and then they weren't that surprising.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But to us, they're not. You know, what I was hoping was, when those moments come, don't they often come when you're just being a person? You're with your daughter, you know, you're with your sweetheart, you're with your abuela. What, you're just out buying some stinking underpants at Target. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, there's a burst that it seems to come from outer space. Like, what? What? And I wanted it to come at moments when readers, I mean, if they've gotten far enough into the book for those moments to come, the readers are already invested in this familia. And by extension, I hope, to all of us who, you know, have Mexican or Latin, for want of a better word, heritage. And it's a shock. Wait, what? Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to be a bump in the road because it's shocking. It's shocking for you to have your life disrupted by somebody who hates you for no reason that you can understand. And then afterwards, for us, it's like, oh, yeah, of course. What's going to happen? We tell ourselves. And I didn't expect all of the politics to be getting so poisonous, you know, over the course of writing the book, but it got worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And I had to really contain my urge, you know, to insult the White House at every page, because that's not what the book was about. But I did want to have those moments. So even on the way to his mother's funeral, Big Angel sees a sign, build the wall, basically telling him, you know, you're not wanted. And he's been in the United States for 60-some years. Mm-hmm. He's a working man. He's raised a whole family. He's my very first Republican hero I've ever had in the story. You know, because I'm trying to show everybody how reasonable I am.
It sort of mirrors what's happening to a lot of us. But I thought it was interesting in the novel that we're sort of moving through the winter of Big Angel's years and yeah. America's life as well. We've moved further along on this timeline that we're all on, and then it rears its head again. I thought, well, maybe that is right. It mirrors what a lot of us are experiencing right now with these attitudes.
Yeah, I think that the argument that, oh, well, you know, you have to deal with racism, but America is not a racist country, and, you know, the bright, shining city on the hill. However, there are these little things. It's almost like people feel you have to go through some ritual hazing to get in the club. Mm-hmm. And I just don't buy it anymore. And what I'm really interested in seeing happen now is the kids who are growing up, and certainly the dreamers. I mean, I consciously put a dreamer in my book, but, you know, the kids, and after what happened in Florida, to watch those kids, they are combating the NRA so fiercely, it fascinates me. Whether you're a gun lover or not, I don't think is the issue, but what I think is the issue is these children are looking at the way things have worked, and they say, nah, doesn't work for me. You guys mess things up, and we're going to change them. And my own daughter, Michaito, she's gotten fierce. She's 18. And at one point, she looked at me and she said, Dad, men are the problem. And I said, men are the problem? What about me? And she said, nah, you got to go too.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. I said, where are we going to go? She said, we're going to put you on an island. We don't even need you to procreate anymore. I thought, wow, what a little radical, you know. But she keeps telling me, Dad, I can vote this year. And there's this whole ocean of young people who have had enough, which fascinates me and gives me hope. They don't know they can't change the world, and that's why they're going to change it. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I think is really moving, if you consider the passage of our history, you know, one of my books was picked by the NEA, right, for the big read. So a couple of times a year, about six times a year, I go to different cities where everybody allegedly is reading the book. Mm-hmm. Certainly in school districts, that book was not intended for kids, but kids are reading. So I am now talking to our kids, our beautiful racita, who are many of them dreamers or undocumented, but even those who aren't, who come to these assemblies with me, and I'm their first author. My book is the first book they've really gotten into, and they are afraid and ashamed, you know, and hurt by all this rhetoric, and they don't know what to do. And to be able to go there and just tell them, you are beautiful. You are sacred. You are the future of this country. You know? And they sometimes resist. They're like, nah, yes. Yeah, take my word for it. And I like to tell them, you know, this thing that you're feeling, this anti, quote, Latino or Latinx vibe that's in the country right now, just do your history. Read on Ben Franklin complaining about Germans. It sounds like what El Presidente says about us. Mm-hmm. You know, Chinese people had a rough time. Italian people, Irish people, you know, those no dogs or Irish allowed signs. Jewish people fleeing the Holocaust. So I tell them it is in some weird way a ritual in our country. We need an other to attack. And I tell them jokingly, and it makes them laugh because the kids can be really sad about this. I say, you just wait. One of these days, the U.S. is going to forget about you and get mad at Norwegians. And they're going to be saying, keep these damn Vikings out of here. Build a wall on the East Coast to keep out the Vikings. I said, that light keeps circling. And you just have to continue what you're doing. Be excellent. Achieve. Show this country something. Show them what you've got. You've got magic. You're blessed. You're strong. You know, you're heroic. And that, to me, is better than a writing career or, you know, alleged fame or any of that, to be able to reach out to those kids and tell them, look, what we walked through this. You're walking through this now. And you guys are making PhDs. You guys are making college now. You're going to the university. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and then they open up books like yours and see their names or names that are familiar or the word carnal or...
Oh, carnal. Orale, wait. You know, what's really funny is I get cholos too, you know, and they're my favorites. And they test me all the time, you know. Orale, loco, digo, está bien de aquellitas, güey. Yeah, and then they want to do the handshake. And when I can do it, they're like, whoa, dude. You look Irish too, man. I said, yeah, I know. Don't hold it against me, homie.
The novel is so moving. I mean, it had me considering that your publishers should have a four Kleenex warning sticker on the cover.
That's what I'm telling people. Get a Kleenex. They'd write to me and say, can't wait for your book. I'd say, buy some Kleenex.
But there are some very funny moments in this book.
Yeah.
And so... were there unexpected moments like that of laughter? I'm thinking of the one of the many guffaw-provoking scenes at America's funeral when you describe the young people posting on social media that they're at a funeral. The absurdity of
it.
Yeah,
right.
But it was so real. It was so real. And maybe that's what made it so funny. But there are many moments like that in the book. So did those moments come from your real lived experiences with your brother Juan and your family?
Oh, gosh. You know, there's a couple of things at play there. One of the rules that I tell my writing workshoppers always is that laughter is the virus that infects us with humanity. And I think it's really hard to sit with another person and laugh, really laugh, as a human being, not making fun of them or mocking them, but to laugh together about something. It's really hard to then get up from that table and say, boy, those people are subhuman. You can't do it. It makes us all us instead of us and them. And the same with sorrow. You know, I think it's the same with sorrow. And when you're composing, I was trying to compose music in a way with this book. You know, I think humor sets a certain tone so that when the sorrows come, you're already tenderized and opened and you really feel it. And all that being said, we are just funny. I've never been around. Well, I can't say never. I've very rarely been around. Certainly a Mexicano family where somebody wasn't really funny, if not everybody. Or they were funny without knowing they were funny. And then afterwards, everybody's like, oh, dang, that was really funny. So, you know, it's true. So those things were going on, and some of it was observational, some of it was invented. Some of it was just an eruption. You know, I'd be writing, and then I'd get this ridiculous idea, and it made me laugh. And I thought, I was trying to make a full portrait of us for people, of course for us, but also for people who don't know us or think they know us or think they own us. You know, I have a Mexican nanny, so I know all about your culture. So no. You don't know what goes on in her home, you know? So all of that, I was trying to be sort of the ambassador to everybody if I could. One of my friends calls me the Pope of Tijuana. He said, you know, you're always trying to save everybody in Tijuana. But I feel that way. It's our responsibility as artists, I think. And so all that goes into it. But and I can't help myself. I don't know why. One of the critics once said that I always write funny tragedies. And I thought, well, that's true. That's kind of weird, actually. I don't know why. But I think it's partially just because we are so, I feel such good, healthy vibe whenever I'm with our ethnic group. It cheers me up.
This is Texas Matters. Yvette Benavidez is speaking with author Luis Alberto Urrea. His latest book is The House of Broken Angels.
Well, and to balance out that humor, I mean, there are some very difficult moments. Was it difficult or cathartic to relive the parts?
It was so painful.
Painful, yeah.
No catharsis, no. Like, you know, there are a couple of passages which I'll never name that I could not write. My wife had to type it for me, and I was crying. I was just saying it out loud. Mm. And I couldn't rewrite them because I didn't want to go there again. And those hewed very closely to the actual, you know, the actual events that inspired the book. But also, there are a couple of scenes of things I wish I could have said to him. And maybe that was catharsis because, again, being Mexicano, my whole family has convinced me now that he's present. He's probably on book tour with me, you know, in spirit form. So maybe he heard those messages even after he was gone.
How much is Big Angel really like one?
Boy, in a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of it, of course, is completely made up. Nobody's from La Paz in the family. There's none of that Chinta Bent stuff. None of that was true. Yeah, I think, you know, when he was sick, when he first got cancer, he called me to tell me he was ill. And I didn't know what to do. You know, we were far away from each other. And I asked him, did he want me to put it on Facebook? And he liked that idea. I said, you know, strangers are very kind on Facebook and they will pray for you. And he said, I like that. Yeah. But I realized, you know, I think he just wanted to be famous. You know, he thought, wow, get 100 strangers to know who he was meant a lot to him. And I put it on Facebook and he got about 150 people praying for him and he liked it and he went into remission. So he kind of attributed that miracle to me and my fans, readers and stuff. And then the next time he got sick, he had 3 rounds of this going to die. The second time we put it up, and there were about 350 people praying for him. And it was really cute because it was, of course, Católico, you know, people doing novenas for him and rosaries and all that stuff. But then you get the Protestants and get some big-time evangelicals, and then you got atheists wishing him positive thoughts and light. Mm-hmm. And then witches, Wiccans, God, and, you know, Buddhists and Muslim people. He had every imaginable kind of faith or reason aimed at him. And he got better again. And the last time he got extremely sick and once again came back. And you know, when he passed, I think it was just his body giving up. Not even necessarily the cancer, but all the other peripheral damage that he couldn't keep going. Mm-hmm. So the scenes, for example, in the novel where Big Angel and Little Angel lie in bed and tell stories and stuff, that's all true. And when the family found out, you ask about being funny. I thought this was really funny. When the family found out that I was in bed, you know, Tio Luis is in bed with Dad. They came and got in bed with us. Oh. And it was like this dog pile, an ever-shifting dog pile of Mexican people in bed with my brother. And I thought that was hilarious, but also holy, you know, how beautiful. And he was so happy, you know, and my wife caught a picture of all of us siblings got together on the bed, and it's the last picture of all of us together. He was partially responsible, maybe, for me wanting to be a writer. He really used to send old paperbacks home with my dad. He was my half-brother from a different mom. Those were science fiction books, not mystery books. I changed it a little bit. And his mom really did die the week before his birthday party. So we really did have the funeral And then the next day, the party. And I think he really was a little irritated that she died and sort of stole his thunder, you know, because he was going to have this party where he could receive praise from everybody. I mean, what a way to go if you are the self-announced patriarca and had some ego, you know, to be able to leave this world hearing all the things that you had done that were good. Mm-hmm. What a cool thing.
Well, I was on Team Juan, following along on Facebook, and
oh, so yo, you remember?
I was one of the católicas.
Qué bueno, gracias. You made three miracles, sister.
You know, and I saw. So I can't help but picture Juan when I read the novel. I couldn't help but picture him. But I noticed in some of those photos on Facebook too. Yeah, I could see sometimes that he looked, of course, frail, but as you say, happy.
Oh, yeah.
And often you looked sad in the photos.
I was heartbroken. No, I say you put on a good face, you know, but you know what's happening. And I felt like sometimes some of my family didn't quite understand what was happening, like the young folks. He was Pops, you know, I had Pops, man. He's the OG. He's going to be here forever. And he knew. In fact, at the end of the night when I left, I left there and went to Dallas, to the Dallas Ideas Festival, and he died. And I had to come back. And when I left, he held my hand and he said, "Don't say goodbye. Don't ever say goodbye to me." And I said, "What do I say?" And he said, "Tell me I'll see you next time." And that was, he knew, and I knew. And I have to say, you know, that singing Las Mañanitas in the book, that really happened. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't contain myself. I was pouring tears during that. And one of my nephews was like, "Yo, tío, are you crying?" I said, "Yeah." He's like, "What are you crying for?" And I said, "Why aren't you crying?" But I realized it was just a cool birthday part, because everybody believed Juan would last forever.
How much are you like Little Angel?
Let me think. I've been trying to escape that question. Well, you know, it's interesting because I think I could identify with the scenario, obviously, because I lived it. You know, my dad left them. My dad married an American woman. My dad had me. And my sister, one of my sisters, told me just recently, "I was so mad at you," she said, "because we thought you had everything." And I was like, you know, he was still the same guy that you knew. It wasn't necessarily a fun all the time in my house. And that was where I sort of expanded from that. And what I really wanted to try to convey to readers was that we are more than the cartoon image of what we are in this culture. And our families contain Chinese people and Apaches. And in my family, you know, at Juan's last party, there's Samoans walking around. And people are like, "Where did those guys come from?" We're everything, including there are white folks and brown folks and black folks and in our families. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of my experience, yeah. And I thought I can extrapolate on that for sure. And the one moment that may be actually me is just one moment when there's a picture he's looking at, and they all took a picture together, and it didn't occur to them to invite me in it. And somebody said to me, "There's the whole family." And I thought, yeah, most of it. But I understood, because they were thinking about their mom, not our dad. You know, there are all of her kids. And so partially what I was trying to get at is that we all have to adjust, right? There are people who have to adjust to being in the U.S. and what it means, the relationship to Mexico. There are people who are in the U.S. trying to adjust to the Mexico part. It's a give and take.
Well, I want to ask you about the perlas and all the women in this novel.
Yeah.
Among these big angel and little angel, among the angels are these santas, you know, who have endured cruel lives, like saints. Where did all of these these women come from, these powerful, strong, complicated women come from?
Well, I think all of my books are actually about women. Mm-hmm. I was raised by women. The men weren't around. Eran mis tías, my cousins, my nina, you know, my madrina. And I always think about the mujeres. That being said, Juan had some pretty amazing women in his family. So Perla, if there are any people in the book that are really closely based on real people, it would be Big Angel and Perla, based on his wife Blanca, certainly on their relationship. I never saw a relationship like that, that they've been married so long and were still so romantically insane for each other. I thought, that's incredible. Look at them. And it was really true that he talked about her like she was Brigitte Bardot, even from his wheelchair. Mm. I'm the luckiest man in the world, carnal. Mira mi mujer. I'd say, yeah, this is great. You were so in love with her. And their daughter, who was a real, I think, hero through all the difficulties. But I think it can be really tough. And I think the things that sort of, not cremitas, you know, not the fresas, but the people who have to work and make it through a tough life, go through a lot of awful things. And women, I think, especially on the border. And I tried to cover all of those parts of the story. Like La Gloriosa was inspired by several women I knew who were, you know, the incredible va-va-voom sister in whatever family. And I thought, that's a real burden, and it's a really difficult burden. And, a couple of the women that I've known in my life did come from milieus like she did, where she was so gorgeous that their families had little restaurants, and they would sort of use her as a lure to get the guys to keep coming back. And she had this terrible responsibility on her that she had to keep herself, any number of these women, incredibly gorgeous so that the business could survive and everybody could eat.
And she's so lonely.
I think she's the loneliest person in the book. But Little Angel is also really lonely. And they have this really odd kind of romantic energy between them. And, you know, the whole book is kind of building up to them actually finally consummating their kind of love. And then I thought it would be really interesting to tweak that a little bit. I don't want to give it away, but maybe it just doesn't have to be a ravishing sex scene, but something more frank and human. And I feel even more intimate what happens between them. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's funnier. You gotta laugh a little bit, especially at the end, you know?
Yeah.
Luis Alberto Orella is the author of the novel, The House of Broken Angels. He will be a featured speaker at the 6th Annual San Antonio Book Festival on April 7th. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.